And nearly two centuries after he died, Lord Byron's posthumous career is still lucrative. The brilliant British poet, Lord Byron, had affairs with women, men, and the occasional relative. One mistress famously called him mad, bad, and dangerous to know. He cultivated his scandalous image, but the poet also had a lifelong correspondence with a very different friend from college, a clergyman named Francis Hodgson. Tomorrow, Byron's letters come up for auction. We ask Gabriel Heaton of Sotheby's to describe them.
As objects, they are just beautiful. The way that you can get a sense of Byron's thought processes from his letters is just spine-tingling. And there are very few letter writers who can match Byron. You know, I'm sure anyone would have received a letter in that distinctive handwriting. They must have thought, well, whatever else happens today, I can be pretty sure there's going to be something interesting in this letter. Because there's always something going on in Byron's life, and he always expresses it so wonderfully.
Give us an example of, say, some of the early letters. And this would be of a time just before Byron was the famous, the superstar that he became in his time.
Well, I mean, you have to imagine the series of letters here. So we have him writing from Lisbon saying, how much he's enjoying Portugal, that the only vices of the people are lice and sodomy. And then back to England, and he's writing about how beautiful the girls are on the estate. And then you have other letters where Hodgson has written to him and said, well, I really think you ought to read this kind of work of Christian apologia and that other work. And Byron responds saying, well, you know, thanks very much for the list, explaining exactly why he isn't a Christian. And I mean, there's no doubt that Byron rather enjoyed teasing, maybe, this sort of rather worthy Christian friend of his. But at the same time, there is no doubt about the real warmth that Byron feels for this man, and that comes across in all of these letters.
And there's one, I gather, that describes Byron's quite stormy romance with a maid, with a servant, by the name of Susan Vaughan. He pours out his heart a bit. Byron does.
Yes, he does. You get a series of letters charting the collapse of the relationship, yes, which have never been published before, where Byron says, you know, it's my fault, I should have realised that no one could love such a man as I. And it's the fragility of Byron that really comes across there. His real forlornness, they're very, very revealing in that way.
Well, kind of at the other extreme, though, possibly the level of literary gossip and calumny is one of his writings. He's upset, apparently, because William Wordsworth has criticized the poet Alexander Pope, who Byron really looks up to. How does he refer to him?
He describes him as Turdsworth, with a great big emphasis under the word turd in the sentence there.
Was that just, as it were, just a one-off, or did he weave into this higher level of correspondence little literary jibes?
There are plenty of rather salacious comments in these letters. This is certainly not the only time where he is rude about Wordsworth. So it was both a literary and a sort of political difference that they had there.
Do we learn from these letters much about Byron the poet?
Yes. I mean, there's a wonderful letter, actually the last letter in the sequence, where he does touch on literary subjects. And then before he finishes off the letter, he goes for a horse ride. And he comes back and he furiously writes this postscript to the letter where he's used up this little bit of paper that he has, and he's writing it every little corner of the paper. He uses this to criticise Hodgson's concept of tragedy, you know, because Hodgson had sort of been writing that the tragic hero has to be a good man. And here we have Byron writing, but, you know, it's clearly this idea has come to him, you know, as he went for his evening ride, comes back and writes, no, 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 that's ridiculous. You know, think of Paradise Lost. Who is the hero of Paradise Lost? Satan. And then he carries on and lists all these tragedies where the hero is clearly not a great man. But of course, this moment of saying Satan is the hero of Paradise Lost, which is a great romantic point, is pretty revealing.
That was Gabriel Heaton of Sotheby's. This is only the second time this group of letters from Lord Byron has been sold. The first time, back in 1885, it was also Sotheby's that auctioned off the letters, which sold for about £150. This time, they're expected to fetch about 1,000 times that sum. It's been 40 years since Congress passed a federal law against hate crimes. Today, President Obama signs a new bill that updates that law. For the first time, it gives federal protection to people who are attacked because they are gay, transgender, or disabled. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports.
As a lobbyist with the gay and lesbian group Human Rights Campaign, David Stacey fought hard for this bill. So it might seem odd that he does not expect many more people to be charged with federal hate crimes once the bill becomes law.
Are there going to be a huge number of prosecutions by the federal government, by the Justice Department, under the statute? No.
State and local officials have always led the majority of hate crime prosecutions. The offenses are the kinds of assaults and muggings that local officials prosecute every day, but with different motivations. And people who oppose hate crime laws say the federal government should have left it that way. But this new law also lets the Justice Department help with local prosecutions by providing federal investigators, forensics, and money. Robert Rabin worked at the Justice Department when the Wyoming college student Matthew Shepard was murdered for being gay. It was 1998, and Rabin remembers sitting in a conference room with the Attorney General, the Wyoming Sheriff, and Matthew Shepard's parents.
I recall, amidst the tears and the affection and the hugs for Matthew Shepard's parents, was the much more analytical and hard and kind of eye-glazing conversation about how to get resources to this poor sheriff.
Hate crimes cases get expensive, especially when protesters and the national media descend on a small town. The sheriff in Wyoming nearly went bankrupt prosecuting the Matthew Shepard case. This new law would let the federal government step in. For Mara Kiesling, one of the most important parts of this bill is symbolic.
It's the first time that transgender people will be in federal code in a positive way.
Kiesling directs the National Center for Transgender Equality.
And that's a really important historical moment for the country, certainly for transgender people, but really also for the country.
Kiesling says the transgender community documents an average of one murder a month. Government statistics don't reflect those numbers, and that's another thing that may change with this bill. The law expands the FBI's ability to track hate crimes. Michael Lieberman of the Anti-Defamation League chairs a federal hate crimes coalition in Washington. He says, in the short term, this law may lead to a rise in the number of reported hate crimes. Here's his reasoning.
If you're an individual who's been the victim of a crime, why would you bother to report that you'd been the victim of a hate crime unless you thought that law enforcement officials were going to take it seriously? So the fact is that after an effective hate crime law has been passed, the numbers actually may go up, and that may be a very good thing because it's a much more accurate reflection of the national problem.
The bill includes provisions to train state and local law enforcement officials about hate crimes, and it also protects people with disabilities for the first time. While disability and gay rights groups are happy to see the symbolic statement of this bill, government officials are ready to put the law to use.
We have a lot of equal opportunity bigots across the United States.
Tom Perez leads the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He recently spoke with WAMU's Kojo Namdi show.
This bill was first introduced in 1996, and I actually had the privilege of working for Senator Kennedy at the time when the bill was being drafted. And so it has been a 13-year marathon.
Both Perez and Attorney General Eric Holder used to work in the criminal section of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. That's the part of the department that prosecutes hate crimes. So as one justice official put it, this law is going to be used extensively. For the gay and lesbian advocacy group Lambda Legal, the opposite would also be good. Kevin Cathcart is the group's executive director.
I don't have a goal for this law to be used over and over again many times every year. My goal or ideal would be for anti-gay violence to taper off and disappear.
President Obama plans to sign the bill in the White House Rose Garden later today. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The cell phone in your pocket is a tracking device, and with the addition of GPS, it's getting more exact. Prosecutors and private investigators have come to depend on this information, but the law is fuzzy about who is really entitled to see your cell phone trail. NPR's Martin Costi reports as part of our series, The End of Privacy.
Jeff Fishback is a little bit like those guys in The Matrix. When he puts on his shades and walks down the street, He sees data.
We have digital meters that monitor when a car moves and resets themselves. We just passed an intercom system that's going to go through a computer. Anything that runs through a computer is going to keep a log.
Fishback is a forensic technologist. Lawyers eagerly pay him for his skill in extracting evidence from everyday devices. He's even checked alibis on kitchen appliances. You know that lie you told in your divorce trial? Your coffee maker may rat you out. But Fishback's bread and butter is cell phones. These days, phone data are the foundation of many a prosecution.
It's been pretty standard the last couple of years. More and more often, I'm finding that it's being used as the sole evidence in a case. That concerns me a little bit.
He's worked on at least 250 criminal cases involving cell phones. Today, he's at the office of San Francisco defense attorney Robert Amparan, who's got a client facing a murder charge.
A gang-related shooting that occurred at corner of Turk and Goff on March 20th, 2008, at about 8 p.m.
On the conference table between them is a sheaf of printouts from the local cell phone company. It's the tower data that prosecutors are using to place the defendant at the scene of the crime. Fishback is here to translate the tower codes and to provide the defense with some reasonable doubt.
What they can reasonably say, they can't say he was here. What they can say is he could have been in the crime scene. That cell sector covers the crime scene.
Fishback regards this kind of tower data as corroborating evidence, something you can use to check someone's story. Still, these data are very valuable for investigators looking for leads or witnesses. So the big question is, who gets to see them?
It's really all over the map.
Fishback says some cell companies just require subpoenas, while others want signed warrants. Sometimes all you need is a little charm.
I even managed to get that sort of information for a defendant recently just by calling up and speaking to someone who was pretty friendly.
Strange as it may seem, here we are 2 decades into the cell phone era, and the rules are still unclear. Real-time tracking does require a warrant. The courts have settled that. But when it comes to the history of where you've been,
it's a mess.
Jennifer Granick is a lawyer and civil liberties director at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She says federal law is out of date and overly complex.
Normal people can't understand it. Defense attorneys can't understand it. It's hard, it's hard for judges to understand it. And it really, when you kind of drill down, doesn't make a lot of sense.
Part of the problem, she says, is that the law puts a lot of importance on esoteric technical details. For instance, the method of calculating your phone's location, whether it's GPS, tower data, or some other method, can actually affect your privacy rights.
It doesn't seem, I think, to the average cell phone owner that there should be a big difference. But because of the technological way that people can get access to your location information, the law surprisingly treats them very differently.
And this leads to uncertainty for law enforcement, too. In theory, phone records are a great way for police to find everybody who is near a crime scene. But only some departments take advantage of this tool. That's partly because it takes a lot of man hours to sift through that many names and numbers, but it's also because the courts haven't settled yet whether that kind of digital dragnet is acceptable. Oklahoma City First Assistant District Attorney Scott Rowland is one prosecutor who says it is.
I don't believe you have any more expectation of privacy in not having your phone number obtained in a cell data dump like that than you do when you go to the shopping mall. The police can go up and down the row and take tag numbers and run and see who's at the mall. You're at the mall and you don't have an expectation that other folks won't see you there.
Rowland gives seminars to fellow prosecutors on how to use cell phone data. He tells them that they don't need a warrant for tower data, but he says they might want to get one anyway, just in case, because the law is still so unsettled.
It's a little surprising to me that the federal courts have been, in my opinion, a little bit slow to take one of these head on and decide the issue.
There is a case pending in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that many experts believe will eventually help to define the privacy protections for phone location. And it can't come too soon, as GPS is now making phone location more precise and part of everyday life.
A person's location is a great conversation starter.
Steve Lee is group product manager for Google Latitude, one of the many services that now let you share your phone location with friends. He calls it a social tool.
I went to Washington, D.C. in January for the Obama inauguration, and a friend of mine, Sarah, who lives in London, I noticed on Latitude was also in Washington, D.C. at the same time.
So it's great for finding friends in a crowd. It could also be big business. At least that's Google's hope, as it explores ways to offer people location-based advertising. Still, the company is going slow, purposefully limiting what Latitude can do. Lee says some people need time to ease into all of this.
Some people describe it as cool but creepy. So I think over time, people become more and more comfortable with it. But it's the kind of thing, you know, not everyone's going to be comfortable with this, and they don't need to share their location with other people.
Our forensic technologist, Jeff Fishback, is one of those who believe it's cool but creepy. He's a little creeped out by what his own new smartphone can do.
And let me tell you how precise mine is and why outside this interview I won't be leaving it turned on. I walked around my own house, and it's not a mansion, and I could see on the phone where I was standing in the house.
At the same time, he welcomes the arrival of services like Google Latitude. He says all these services are really doing is making visible the kind of data that he sifts through for a living. And it's probably a good thing for people to start seeing the trail of digital breadcrumbs that they've been leaving all along. Martin Kosty, NPR News.
To test just how precise the new GPS-enabled phones are, Martin and his editor took two phones, one with GPS and one without, on a tour of Los Angeles landmarks and compared their accuracy. You can see the results and hear the other stories in this series at npr.org.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Technology earned billions for Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates. Now the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation depends on technology to solve some of the world's biggest problems. That foundation has spent years working to improve global health, attacking diseases like AIDS or malaria. And the couple whose names are on the foundation visited the nation's capital this week. They are thanking taxpayers for their generosity. Government aid for health overseas increased dramatically under President Bush and remains high today, even in a time of big deficits. Yesterday, we sat down with Bill and Melinda Gates in a Washington hotel, and we spoke of the way that they target their money.
You know, the U.S. government spends $8 billion a year on global health. 0.25% of the U.S. budget, so not a gigantic percentage, but it's over five times what we spend. And, you know, we tend to focus on a lot of the research-type things, new vaccines. The $8 billion is very focused on delivering the things that work. So we often work together, but only by having that large amount of resources, the government expertise, and the U.S. government setting an example for other rich governments. That's the only way the global health endeavor has managed to be so successful.
What's an example of how you think about where you want to direct your resources? I mean, if we just think about something like AIDS, there are a million medical and political opinions about what is appropriate or the best way to approach that?
Well, I think one of the things you have to understand is fundamentally, Bill and I believe in the advances of technology. And in this field, it's biotechnology. If you didn't have a life-saving vaccination available, you don't change the face of a disease. So ultimately, our long-term goal is to get a vaccine for AIDS. So we're always saying to ourselves, okay, which proposals have the best chance of getting an AIDS vaccine? And we work a lot with the scientific community on that. And then the discussion comes down to, okay, but given that we don't have a vaccine, what other pieces do we invest in today to make sure we prevent the disease as much as we can or even help treat people? So those are the conversations back and forth, is much more how much money are we going to put into the research pieces versus the pieces on the tools that actually do exist today.
You talk about technology and preventing the disease. You've spent a number of years trying to develop something, a microbicide that women can take themselves that serves the same function as a condom, say. Can you just talk through what directed you to that idea and what the result have been, good and bad?
Well, the microbicide trials have not been successful so far. There's some of those that we fund going on. The U.S. government funds a lot as well. We were hopeful for the early microbicide stuff, but Even when those trials failed, we stuck with the area. We still think something can work.
And I think that's a really important point to realize, is the role of a foundation is that we can take risks where a government won't or can't take the risks sometimes. So we kept trying different microbicides, and as we learned from one, we try another.
I was interested in this example, though, because it seems like it points to the possibilities of technology as well as some of the challenges, the possibilities being that I guess a woman can make the decision herself about protecting herself, and there are a lot fewer political or just physical barriers to that if it works. And of course the challenge is finding something that actually works and that you can reliably deliver to a lot of poor people in a lot of poor places.
Absolutely, because if a woman can protect herself covertly from her partner, that is incredibly important in the developing world. She can save herself and save the life of her child. And a lot of times it's important even that the woman's husband doesn't know that she's doing this, because he might be bringing AIDS home, which is often what happens, and then she inadvertently gives it to her child.
But then there's the question of getting it to work. Do you wonder sometimes about the limits of technology in less developed areas?
Well, there are limits, absolutely. But in this case of microbicide, if we can end up getting a pill instead and the woman can take that, it'll make a complete difference. So not all technology works, but you have to pick appropriate technologies that'll work in the developing world.
I'd like to ask you about an argument that I'm sure you've heard in one form or another. Some time ago on the program, we spoke with Dambisa Moyo, an economist, who wrote a book criticizing Western efforts to help Africa. And one specific example she zeroed in on was mosquito netting, which is something that you folks have been involved with providing. Obviously, it can be great for preventing mosquito bites, which can spread malaria. But Dambisa Moyo argued that it's a very simple, cheap product that someone locally in Africa could produce, and you could develop an economy and improve the standard of living in many ways. And instead, a shipload of mosquito netting arrives from somewhere and makes an African country dependent on Western aid in ways that she finds counterproductive.
Well, I think it's pretty outrageous to say that you ought to wait some years to create a few hundred jobs and let hundreds of thousands of children die. You know, as you have bad health, families have more children just to increase the chance that some will survive to adulthood. You have huge population growth, which means that feeding kids, educating kids, it really becomes impossible. So the first intervention is to get health to be reasonable. Health aid is something that allows a country to get on its feet. It's incredible that somebody could say that it's bad for Africa to save children's lives.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things we want to make sure that we get across, is that the aid we're seeing that's going to African health is making enormous impact. So if a mother's baby doesn't get malaria that year, she's not dealing with that disease and not having to deal. I mean, an ill child from malaria is a horrific thing. Talk about not being able to go out and work in your field. You're there tending the baby. Where we've got tools that work today, it makes complete sense to deliver them to the developing world.
I'm just curious, and this must be very hard as very practical, successful people to admit, but has there been an occasion where you've let some foundation money out the door, and after a couple of years you would say, that was pretty much a failure. That was wasted money. Didn't work.
Well, we've done a lot of things like that, some of which the group did their best, but say it was a scientific dead end. We've had others where the group maybe didn't execute super well.
And sometimes you make a mistake where it's a fantastic investment, but there's a little piece of it you didn't get right. So a great example is rotavirus. We have, thank God, an amazing life-saving vaccine that's coming for kids. And it's actually being delivered now in Nicaragua. We're going to get it out in lots of places. It's a vaccine against diarrhea. So the science technology piece of it was just phenomenal what happened. We, at the time, maybe weren't smart enough to ask for the packaging in the right way or to make sure the systems just kind of took care of that. So when rotavirus came out, it requires cold chain.
Cold chain,
which is you have to keep the vaccine cold all the way up until it gets into the kid's mouth or arm.
Refrigeration into very poor areas.
And so at the very last piece of the mile, you're carrying that thing in a backpack with a cooler, right? Well, unfortunately, the rotavirus packaging came out too large. We had these large boxes. Well, you can't carry large boxes of vials of vaccinations out into villages. That requires too much refrigeration. And so we had to go back and say, my gosh, we have to have much, much smaller vials and packaging. And that took time.
That sounds like actually a classic example of what can go wrong with a well-intentioned project.
Sure. And so you just learn from it. And you say, okay, that's a small mistake we made. We're not going to make that mistake again.
Bill and Melinda Gates, thanks very much for the time. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
That's Bill and Melinda Gates here in Washington, D.C. And by way of full disclosure, we should note that NPR receives support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is caught up in a number of sex scandals. But for a long time, Italian women had been largely silent about his behavior. Well, that changed after Berlusconi made a remark about an opposition politician's lack of good looks. It unleashed a wave of anger among Italian women. Tens of thousands have now signed a petition that says, "This man offends us, stop him." NPR's Silvia Pajoli reports from Rome.
Here's a sampling of Berlusconi quips. "Women are God's most beautiful gift to men. In order to prevent rape, we would need as many soldiers as there are beautiful Italian women." He boasts of the good looks of his party's young female MPs, dismissing the opposition ranks as menopausal. In September, the prime minister informed a gathering of journalists,
"Che nella mia vita io non ho mai neppure una volta."
I have never paid for sex. For those who love to conquer, the joy and the most beautiful satisfaction is in the conquest. If you have to pay, what joy is there?
Berlusconi's sex scandals came to light when his wife announced she was divorcing him. The prime minister, she said, is a man who consorts with minors. Later, numerous young women, including a call girl, said they had attended parties at Berlusconi's home. But surprisingly, in a country where during the 1970s women made massive political gains, there was little or no female protest about the prime minister's womanizing. Former MP Tana De Zulueta blames a feminist movement she says was too elitist.
"It really was one of Europe's most interesting and lively feminist movements. They didn't want to go mainstream. They didn't want to mix."
The mood suddenly changed earlier this month when Berlusconi called in to a late-night talk show and made a jab at a female opposition MP. "You're more beautiful than you are intelligent," Berlusconi snipped. 58-year-old Rosy Bindi retorted, "I am not a woman at your disposal." The prime minister's insult sparked outrage. A group of women drafted a petition saying Berlusconi's statements offend female dignity and accusing him of using women's bodies for his political ends, denigrating women and democracy in the process. And in 11 days, more than 100,000 women signed the petition protesting against this cretinization of women. Even the old feminist movement has come back into the open. Rome's International Women's Center was overflowing for a seminar with the title "Sex and Politics in Post-Patriarchy." Political scientist Francesca Izzo went straight to the point.
"It was women who revealed that Berlusconi's the emperor with no clothes, starting with his wife. And the scandals surrounding the prime minister have been like a violent slap in the face for millions of women who are just now waking up from a state of passivity."
Another Italian woman who has rebelled against the female image promoted by Berlusconi's three TV networks is Lorella Zanardo, who has had a successful business career abroad.
"So when I came back and I watched television, I really couldn't accept this humiliation, this lack of dignity. So it was really something disturbing physically even. I said, basta, basta, basta."
"Enough," she said. But then she reacted and produced a documentary of images of women on Italian TV. It's a visual essay called "Women's Bodies," showing what she calls grotesque, vulgar, and humiliating creatures with inflated silicone bodies oozing out of plunging necklines, tottering on stiletto heels. Zanardo is proud to say that already more than 800,000 women have watched her film on the Internet, which she believes is where the new Italian women's movement is coming to life. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
There is a passionate, even angry debate in this country over the safety of vaccines, set off by fears that kids are over-vaccinated or that vaccines can cause autism. Numerous studies have failed to show a connection between vaccines and autism. Journalist Amy Wallace takes this on in the November issue of Wired magazine. Her article is titled, "An Epidemic of Fear: How Panicked Parents Skipping Shots Endangers Us All." And as you can tell from the title, Wallace has an opinion on the matter. The story doesn't end there. Since the article was published, Wallace has been receiving a torrent of response, some of it vitriolic. Amy Wallace joins me here at NPR West. Thanks for coming in, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
Your piece is largely a profile of a pediatrician named Paul Offit, who had invented a vaccine for rotavirus. He's a vaccine expert. He's also, though, a lightning rod for criticism in the anti-vaccine community.
Yes, partly he's risen to that level of lightning rodhood, if that's a word, by writing a book last year called Autism's False Prophets that attempts to untangle this emotional issue and talk about what the science actually shows and what the science doesn't show. We at Wired wanted to use a profile of him as a way into a broader issue, which is vaccine panic. People are afraid. Educated people are afraid. Many of them are. Even people who do vaccinate are worried about the impacts on their children.
Paul Offit's point, and the point you make in your article, is that people are ignoring the math here, that any risks from the vaccines are completely dwarfed by the risk of childhood disease.
Yeah, I mean, there's an irony going on here, which is that vaccines have done such a good job of removing the visible threat of pertussis or whooping cough, of the measles, that it has started to feel to some parents like the risks of getting a vaccine are larger than the risks of dying of some of these childhood diseases. And as a result, what's happened is that there have been outbreaks because there are pockets of the country where educated people largely have decided to take it upon themselves to become experts, not vaccinate their children because they believe that they know better than the experts, and therefore have left whole pockets of a community very wide open to an outbreak of illness.
Let's talk about some of the response you've gotten to this article, starting with the vitriolic response that we mentioned. What have you heard from people?
Well, I've heard a lot of anger. I've heard that I'm stupid. I've heard that I'm greedy. I've heard that I did this to get famous. I've heard that I'm a whore. I'm a prostitute. I've heard several times, and it's been written about now a lot on the blogosphere from J.B. Handley, who's the founder of Generation Rescue, which believes there are too many vaccines given too soon and lays the blame for autism at the feet of vaccines. He's said that Paul Offit raped me intellectually. He's questioned where I went to school. There's a bullying tactic that is part of some of this debate that makes a lot of scientists very reluctant to speak out because they just want to do their work. They don't want to have a full-time job campaigning for this. And I think it's important to not be cowed by that. There are some things in life that are true. And I think the debate needs to be civil. That's part of what I've been trying to participate in, a civil discussion of these issues.
Have any of the negative comments you've gotten caused you to rethink how you wrote the piece, think about voices you might have included that weren't there, or points that are made that you didn't cover?
One of the things I hadn't included at all in the story was autistic people do not die of autism. They grow up and they become autistic adults. And I heard from several people talking about how they appreciated the story. They didn't believe that vaccines had caused their autism, but they wish that people didn't talk about autism as if it were a death sentence. And that's been a really moving, interesting sideline that I hadn't delved into at all. I and Wired did what we set out to do, which is to use Dr. Offit's story to illustrate a broader issue. So I don't have any regrets, but I guess I would turn it around and say I'm really gratified that it has started such a conversation or continued or made more public a conversation that happens every day.
Amy Wallace, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Amy Wallace is a writer based in Los Angeles. We've been talking about her story in the current issue of Wired magazine titled "An Epidemic of Fear: How Panicked Parents Skipping Shots Endangers Us All."
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.